Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Restaurants are big business in San Francisco. The city boasts 55 Michelin-starred restaurants and has more restaurants per resident than any other major metropolitan area in the U.S. This town loves to eat out, and its chefs are often celebrities in their own right. But what does it take to run a restaurant in San Francisco? How have changing eating habits, technology, and rising costs of living in the city impacted restaurants? Tonight, we will be taking a behind-the-scenes look at the joys and the challenges of this celebrated industry. All of my guests are joining me here in the studio. Charles Balilis, he's a chef, founder, and owner of Souvla, a local chain of restaurants that focuses on Greek cuisine. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Joseph.
We're also joined by Carrie Blees. She's co-founder and chef of Lord Stanley, named one of the country's best new restaurants in Bon Appetit magazine in 2016, and the holder of a Michelin star. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Gwyneth Borden, Executive Director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. Welcome, Gwyneth.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And of course, we'll invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. So, Gwyneth, I'm going to start with you. I just want to kind of get a sense of the numbers. How many restaurants are there in San Francisco?
There are nearly 4,000 food permits in San Francisco with 64,000 workers in the industry. We now make up more than 52% of the retail sales tax collected in San Francisco, so we are a big and mighty industry here.
And 55 Michelin stars. How many of those stars have been accumulated in the last decade, and how many have we had for a while?
It's just in the last several years, because Michelin came here, I think, 2014 might have been. I mean, yes, it was longer than that we were here, but I think that they've really ramped up their their star total in, like, post 2014. But they've been here for a while, and we're very fortunate because some cities they've been and then they've left. And we are very fortunate that we're a city that they constantly return to.
And how stable is that number of 4,400, 4,000 or so restaurants?
I mean, it fluctuates, clearly. Right now, we've had the last several years large growth in the industry, so there are more restaurants now than ever before. But, you know, on a daily basis, unfortunately, restaurants do go out of business, some of them with more fanfare than others.
So what would you say is the average lifespan of a restaurant in San Francisco?
Most people say around 3 years, but it just depends, of course. I mean, there are restaurants who've been here since the 1850s, and then there are restaurants who unfortunately don't make a full year.
So 3 years, that's not a lot of time, is it?
No, I mean, it's a very tough industry. What people forget is the moment you open your doors, you're already heavily in debt, right? It's not like a software company where you can do it at your house and a few people make something that replicates 100 times. I mean, you have to build out your space to make it a restaurant.
You can't sell future equity in the company, right?
Well, I mean, you can, but it's a lot different, right? I mean, in terms of the profit margins are not the same. On average, profit margins are 4 to 6%. Yes, people do better to that in some instances, but it's a heavy labor industry. You can have a software company with 50 people that might make $100 million. You're never going to have a restaurant with 50 people making $100 million. It's just not possible. And so that's where the dance is. We also are an industry where all of your customers are local, right? So you really depend on the people that walk by your restaurant or live in a jurisdiction. You don't have customers that you can't outsource your supply chain to another country. I mean, everything is really local, and so all your costs are very localized, but your impact is always, like, right, largely a very local impact. So all the other, your suppliers are generally local, the people that you hire are local, and the impact on the merchant corridors that you might be in is very local, because restaurants are economic engines in neighborhoods. People go to restaurants, and then they go buy a t-shirt or pick up something from the drugstore. So they are real anchors, and that's why increasingly you've seen more traditional retail that's been suffering since Amazon going into the food and beverage space, trying to offer some sort of food and beverage experience, because people eat every single day, but they don't buy things necessarily.
It's not
every
optional.
Day.
Yeah. and so national statistics show that about 30% of restaurants fail in their first year. How does San Francisco compare?
You know, it's really hard to get good numbers. Our health department doesn't, because when permits turn over, that sometimes is just a change of an ownership structure with an existing restaurant. So we don't really know that number.
Okay. So that gives us a good starting frame for our conversation today. It makes me think of, you know, restaurants, they're constantly teetering, just as perhaps bad as like the airline industry. So I want to turn to you, Carrie Blees and Charles Belilis, and ask you, how on earth did you decide to go into such a tenuous business? Let's start with you, Carrie.
It's funny. I mean, we talk about that amongst ourselves all the time in the restaurant business, and it's kind of, you know, I think the running joke, Charles, maybe you can agree with me, is, you know, we don't do it for the success rate. We don't do it for money. We do it because we're so passionate about it, right? And we're, you know, just so passionate about it. And we're here because of the ingredients. And, you know, San Francisco's obviously got amazing local produce and seafood, et cetera. And so it's kind of, and obviously many restaurants are drawn here because of that reason. So, you know, you kind of just wanted to be a part of that.
And Charles, what would you say?
I mean, it's definitely a labor of love, you know, for those. I got into it on the culinary side, you know, 15 years ago because I love to cook and I like to make people happy. And that has kind of evolved over time. I'm probably one of the few that actually went to school for all of this stuff. Most people kind of accidentally find themselves in the restaurant business, which is nothing to speak ill of. But being able to experience both the sort of culinary education and also sort of the business education as well, it's just one of those things where this is kind of the only thing that I know how to do, really.
So these are, I understand, the first restaurants that either of you have owned or founded. What were you doing before this, and how did you decide that to take the leap to go to ownership as opposed to just working in the industry as a chef, for example?
I mean, one of the reasons myself and Rupert, you know, you work so hard, you put so many hours into it, and it's kind of, you get to the point where, you know, you are putting all of yourself essentially into it, and so you would rather just do it for yourself than for somebody else. And
is it like renting versus owning?
No,
it's
was the same thing for me. It's you kind of reach a point in your career working for other incredibly talented chefs and restaurateurs, it's such a massive commitment that you you sort of reach a point where sort of the light bulb goes off and it says, well, listen, if I'm going to keep on doing this, if I'm going to keep on breaking my back for these other operators, I might as well just do it for myself.
Yeah,
it is a total commitment.
And I imagine one of the things you didn't mention but you kind of alluded to, Gwyneth, is that the upfront costs, the startup costs for a restaurant are quite high. Can you give us a ballpark?
Gosh, it just depends on. I mean, you know, I know someone having a gelato, a small gelato, 3,000 square foot shop being built out, and just the build out for that is about $300,000, right? And how much gelato, and what are you going to price the gelato? So you think about $300,000, not including the rent and the months that you're paying rent while it's being built out. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have to buy product. You're going to have to buy equipment to put into the facility. Then you're going to have to hire staff. So that it kind of escalates. So it's easy. I mean, even in a more turnkey space where you're going to go in and maybe use someone's existing infrastructure, I mean, you're still looking at probably at least $100,000. I mean, the numbers go up from there depending on what kind of concept you're doing and how deep the remodel is and if there are any sort of challenges that you come across the way or if zoning has changed that requires things that weren't previously required. So it's not as easy as people think.
So what was it like, Charles, for you to open your first Souvla? I mean, I imagine you said you went into this as both on the production side, meaning the chef side, and the business side. Was it what you expected?
I think that it was. It definitely took a lot longer, and it was a lot harder than I had expected. It took about from inception to doors open was about 6 years, and that's a combination of, you know, writing a business plan, tearing it up, and rewriting that, and sort of rinse repeat there, and then it was about 2 years in finding the right space, and another, you know, on top of that, raising capital. We raised just under $500,000 for the first, so it was a very small, scrappy project. To answer the sort of previous question, I would, you know, to open a restaurant in San Francisco, obviously varies greatly in the concept, but I would say it requires anywhere between $500,000 and probably $6-7 million on the higher end. People have opened restaurants for more than that, but so they're not cheap. It was a tremendous challenge for me to raise capital the first time around because I was an unproven operator. I had a great pedigree. but I was an unproven operator. The concept was totally new. No one our format certainly back in 2011, 2012, when I was actively raising capital, was kind of foreign. And so there are a lot of those unknowns. And so it was a lot of rejection, and it was a lot of rejection from people that you had kind of – that I had relationships with, and people that I knew had the capacity to invest. But then you kind of hit this point where you're sort of past the point of no return, where there's a lease signed, and you've got and you're in build out and you're trying to raise money, and it's this kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul a little bit, and it's super scary. But it's also a lot of fun.
And what was it like for you, Carrie, surprises along the way as you went from concept to getting the money to finding the space to actually finally opening your doors?
For sure. I mean, it's definitely a scary endeavor, absolutely. And I think one of the things that Rupert and I always say to each other is we're lucky that we have each other. So it's like when one of us kind of has our moment of, oh, my God, is this going to work? What are we doing? The other one kind of brings us back to reality and is like, we're gonna do it, it's gonna be okay, like, let's keep going. So we feel lucky that we had that support system. But I mean, yeah, it's hard in the city. There's always the unforeseeables, with your build out. You say like, I have this much for design, I have this much for construction, etc. And then once you get into it, there's always the unforeseeables. Like, you get into your plumbing and, oh, this isn't correct, and or the licensing from one business to another, maybe some things need to be upgraded, and there's always things that come up that you're not looking for, essentially.
Yeah.
So
without fail, every single time. And we're building out our fourth restaurant right now, and it's without exception.
And maybe quickly, what were, if you look back, one of the things that almost made you kind of walk away from this, but that you eventually persevered, obviously, to get where you are now? What can you just describe it quickly about, what obstacle you came up?
I have a good one, and it was a little bit less on the build out side of things. It was more on the concept side of things. I had committed to an investor lunch, and it was the first time that I was publicly showing people what I wanted Suvla to be, and I had roasted 2 whole lamb the day before, and it was just me prepping this lunch for about 50 people. And I was late into the night. I was picking lamb meat off of a carcass and just standing over this tub of spit-fired lamb. And I just kind of – I sort of broke down a little bit. I was just like, no one's going to want this. Why am I doing this? This seems crazy. You just kind of hit that point of like borderline sort of exhaustion and fear. And the only thing that honestly kept me going is that I knew I had to make lunch for these people tomorrow. At the very least, I had to put something out.
And so that wanted to go to waste.
Exactly.
And how about you, Carrie?
There's many obstacles. I think the first thing that really shook us was, we had our soft opening, and it's like you have all your investors come, your friends and family, and it's your first service with your new staff, et cetera. And, it's never going to be perfect, right? There's always things that are going to happen that you're like, oh my God, that was awful. What are we going to do tomorrow? But that's the point of doing it, is you learn from that and grow from that and, continue on, and the next day is another day.
So let's talk a little bit. You mentioned it a little bit there, Charles, about your concept. Let's talk about concept. How does one pick a concept? Is it because you have this vision that you just always wanted to do X? How much is it influenced by the market forces, or what kind of money you can attract, or the type of food you're going to sell? A little bit of everything. But just tell us, first of all, how you arrived at your concept. So go back to you, Charles Balilis of Suvla.
Sure. Suvla was really, I think of its origin in actually two distinct kind of buckets. There's the concept of Suvla in terms of that really centered around a combination of my Greek American heritage and sort of my interesting and at times conflicting relationship with my cultural heritage, being of Greek descent but being born in the U.S. And then also really centering around the modernization of the gyro or souvlaki sandwich, and really taking that into the 21st century and sort of giving it the kind of quote unquote chef treatment that that we had seen happen over the last 15 years to the taco and the hamburger and all of these other sort of cultural comfort foods, if you will. And sort of everything that sort of lives with that, and then I see the second bucket as this fine fast model that we very much pioneered, where even though you're ordering at the counter, the rest of the experience feels a lot more like a full service restaurant.
And why did you pick the fine fast model?
So my background up until opening Suvla was always in fine dining, working at Michelin-starred restaurants and in various capacities, being in the kitchen, in the dining room, and certainly in the back office, and getting my sort of position leading up to Suvla. Spent a little bit more time focusing on the actual financials, writing budgets, doing profit and loss reviews, and things like that, and. The largest takeaway for me at that point in time was that full service restaurants, no offense, Carrie, but are fundamentally flawed as a business model. There are so many things that have to go into creating a Michelin starred dining experience that at the end of the day there's not a whole lot left over. I mean, what Gwyneth was mentioning at the start of the show, you know, about 4-6% profit margins is very much true. And so when I was starting to think a little bit, you know, about Suvla, when I had the sort of light bulb for the moment for the sandwich, I was also thinking about, okay, how can I take a lot of the service standards and touch points from my fine dining career and sort of strip out the non-essentials and kind of rethink this from a business model standpoint.
So this is about really about cost and maximizing your
profit.
Return.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we spend so much time talking about food, about talking about the experience, talking about the, you know, we sort of romance restaurants, right? And we forget about the fact that they're businesses at the end of the day, right? And they have to make money. Right. So this isn't some sort of crazy capitalist sort of push, but at the end of the day, it's like, okay, well, we're gonna run a business here, right? And the goal of the business is to create value not only for our guests and for our investors, but obviously, you know, to be able to generate profit.
So continuing with the kind of the airline analogies here, what kind of airline model were you? You know, there's the premium, the premiers, like the Emirates and all, right?
Sure.
And then there's the, like, the Spirit or whatever, and then maybe Southwest in the middle. How were you trying to bring these experiences together to create something that you were going to be proud of?
If I were to position Suvla as an airline, I would probably position it as Delta, not only because I personally am a big Delta fan and big Delta flyer, but Delta's been able to sort of bridge the gap between all segments, and I think offering tremendous value no matter what sort of fare you are flying in, and I think that for Suvla, it's there's something similar there where, you know, if you come into one of our restaurants at night, right, the lights are down, there's candles on the table, everyone's drinking wine, it looks and acts and feels like a full service restaurant, although you're not maybe paying the same price that you would if you were dining at a full service restaurant, but we can kind of consider that the sort of premium type situation, nice enough that you would be able to that you will, and people do, many have, bring a date there, and then you also have the sort of low cost type situation. I'm ordering online, I'm buzzing over, cutting the line, I'm picking up my food, I'm going back to the office type mm-hmm. type situation,
or you and, order at the counter if you're going to stay there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So
Carrie, where would you put yourself?
interesting question with the airline reference. I don't know. I mean, not to like go the British route just because of Rupert, but maybe something along the lines of like Virgin America, something like that, where, you know, it's like taking, I guess, like a higher class experience, but to maybe a more casual atmosphere, how you can fly from like San Francisco to LA, but feel like all seats are in a first class, you know. And I think that's what, you know, from conception, when we were thinking of what we wanted to do for Lord Stanley, we always wanted something, you know, we're from, again, fine dining backgrounds, and we wanted refined food, but in a very casual atmosphere. So we wanted people to feel comfortable. We want, like, everyone to be able to come. And, you know, we get a lot of calls for what's the dress code, and anything's welcome. We have no dress code. So we want it to be like a casual sort of homey feeling atmosphere, but that you can get a refined experience, get refined food, have quality service. And
so would you call yourself fine casual as well, or similar?
Yeah, fine casual.
Fine casual, yeah. Okay. But it sounds like you're not the same fine casual as Charles.
No.
And the costs were higher, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you decide to, you know, or, I mean, how did you succeed at being able to pull the funding in to be able to do that in a market such as this one?
I mean, you know, a lot of our investors were friends and family. Luckily, you know, people that just kind of wanted to support us, support what we were doing. And that led us to other investors who, you know, from talking to different people, it was, you know, people in San Francisco that kind of said, I want to invest in something that I can kind of feel in touch in a way and something that feels personal to me. And they wanted to be able to come in and, you know, see what they're investing in, know the people that they're investing in, and just kind of have a closer relationship instead of something that they maybe were just going to put money into and see something, you know, more of a on an online basis than in a personal manner.
But you have servers, mm-hmm. right? So which is different. I mean, your folks run the food, Charles. You don't have someone who comes and takes your order outside the counter, person. How do you make ends meet when you have additional labor costs that come with having a more full service model?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's hard. There's a lot of costs. Obviously, the big thing in San Francisco's labor cost is super high. I think Rupert and I are lucky in the fact that, you know, we both kind of hold management roles, so we're not paying, you know, a massive salary for an executive chef. We have Rupert in the kitchen, you know, and myself in the kitchen, and I've actually moved on and taken a front of house manager role, so we're not, you know, paying a general manager. So we have those costs kind of cut out of our daily expenses and our salaries, which is, you know, I think huge for us, and we're so small that it definitely does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. And you said, both of you said that, you know, working for somebody else versus working for yourself, you know, that switch meant a lot. Do you feel like you're working less or more than you were before now that you're working for yourself?
I think that you end up, when you're running restaurants, you're effectively working all of the time. But yeah. I think that it really comes down to, at least for me, you know, about a couple years in, I was fortunate enough to kind of have a shift because we knew that we wanted to grow. Where, you know, in the early days of Souvlaki, I was opening and closing the restaurant every day. I mean, literally, you know, 7-8 in the morning to, you know, 11 o'clock midnight. But the goal was to build and sort of develop and mentor a team of people, which I've been very, very fortunate enough to do. And so now. Now my role is kind of, you know, sort of cliche, I guess, as it sounds. I'm working more on the business than in the business, and I'm super, super fortunate to have just an incredible team of women and men that run our restaurants on a daily basis. So that mm-hmm. I'm, so even though I'm always thinking about Souvlaki, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm always answering emails and this or whatever, I'm not in it in the way that I used to be.
Mm. Another question for both of you, which is. What's the typical age bracket demographic of your customers? I'm curious. Is there a difference here?
Yeah, ours is super varied. We get, you know, a lot of an older crowd, you know, that comes, you know, between the 5:30 and 7:30 kind of thing, and then we'll get a lot of, you know, 20s to 35 kind of range. So we're super varied on any given night, and it can be all in one night, all in, you know, a different night, but it's.
So it's not a generational thing, who likes fine dining versus, you know, fine fast or fine casual. Yeah. How about you?
Same deal. Really, really, really runs the gamut from children all the way up to, you know, pre-theater. One of our restaurants is located very close to the Symphony and Jazz Center and Opera House. So it's really runs the gamut. Time of day of week, time of year. You know, right now, the sort of the height of San Francisco tourist season, bringing in a lot of people from out of state or out of the country our way, which is always nice, too.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the restaurant business in San Francisco. In the studio with me here are Charles Belilis, owner and founder of Souvlaki, a chain of fine casual Greek restaurants based in San Francisco, Carrie Blees, co-chef and owner of Lord Stanley, a Michelin star restaurant recognized by Bon Appetit as one of the top new restaurants in the country, and Gwyneth Borden, executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. When you dine out, what kind of restaurants do you like to go to? Does counter service appeal to you, or would you rather have table service, the typical fine dining experience? Tell us more about how you decide where and when to dine in San Francisco. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website, or you can tweet us at City Visions KALW. So, Gwyneth, I wanted to turn back to you because we just talked with Carrie and Charles about sort of the ins and outs of running the business, what how they got there, the passion, the devotion to doing this kind of work. And yet there are a lot of things that are working chipping at their heels every day that may make their business teeter into bankruptcy. So tell us what – give us an overview again of what do restaurant owners have to contend with?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the city actually hired a person, much at our urging, who's kind of the restaurant accelerator person at the city level looking at what it takes to get a restaurant open. So they mostly focus on opening restaurants and restaurants maybe going through maybe new projects and renovations. And it was 27 pages of permits and city agencies and state agencies and others that they had to be in interaction with. And the challenge just in that process is none of those other agencies care or seem to realize that you are sometimes waiting on them to go to the next level. So, you know, you have all the bureaucratic stuff that exists in the process that slows down the time in which you can actually occupy your space. And it was mentioned earlier when you build out a space, there every time you pull a net new permit, so when a new operator comes in, things that weren't triggered by maybe someone had the space for a very long time, but the building codes change for hoods or for ADA access, etc. So all of those things become triggered. So you have all of that up front. Then you have to hire people in a market where housing's expensive, workers are scarce, and trying to staff your restaurant is pretty close to impossible for a lot of people. If you search restaurant jobs in San Francisco, you can find Michelin-starred restaurants to your local deli looking for labor. I mean, people ask me every day if there's someone that they can find, if there's someone for me, I know that they can hire, and I'm like, I wish I would be rich if I had a pool of restaurant workers to give to people, but I don't. So you have all of those things in combination. Then we have the labor costs, because costs are rising because there's scarcity and a shortage. Then we have rising minimum wage, healthcare costs, rent, all the other sort of costs, all well-meaning and all well-intentioned. But you know, for restaurants, the only option you have is to pass those costs along to the consumer, and there's a real sensitivity, because there is a friction, right? People are willing, they have in their mind how much a sandwich should cost or a cup of soup. And when you get too high up in what that might be, then they don't come to your restaurant anymore. And it doesn't matter how great it is. That cost does matter. And people think, oh, it doesn't. But what's really happening a lot in the industry is that the two fastest growing segments are kind of fast and fine casual and fine dining, right? Because both offer an experience and great experiences. But the mid-service, full-service restaurant is really struggling because of all the different pressure points that I mentioned. Fast casual offers you the opportunity to sell volume, and fine dining offers experience, and you have a limited number of seats and a lot more people who want to occupy those seats than typically number of days that you're open, so you can keep it going for quite some time. And so that's the economics of the situation are really changing, and I think in the future you're going to see a lot more different models that people are trying where they limit the amount of service, not because they don't want to provide it. It's because it's almost impossible to be able to stay in business in doing so. And so, you know, Carrie talked about the innovative ways because her husband and herself are actually, you know, key staff members. And Charles talked about his model. But that's really what you're starting to see, because the costs are, you know, impossible. I mean, you can't even fill the roles even if you could afford to pay people whatever you'd like.
So you mentioned a lot there about costs, basically, right? So the bureaucracy and the permits. You talked about labor costs. You talked about how wages have to go up because workers are scarce, and I want to get into more of why that is in a moment. And those types of things. How does for lack of a better term, demand, meaning what people are looking for or what people do with their spare time or their time they spend eating. How does that also put pressure on what models work for restaurateurs?
Well, the biggest area you can see is in delivery. There are a lot of restaurants that traditionally shouldn't be or wouldn't be in delivery, but they absolutely have to. Consumers are increasingly demanding the convenience of delivery, and they want any kind of food available to them. And now there are multiple platforms that, for a restaurant, that might expose you to a different pool of clients that you might not have seen otherwise across the city or in a city where they're visiting the newly. So that is a really good example of something that's really stretched and changed the industry. And quite frankly, for a lot of people, delivery, while it's not very profitable, if people ran the numbers, it probably isn't profitable at all. It is a place where people feel like they have to be because they need as much exposure as possible to potential new customers.
Why isn't delivery more more profitable? Your overhead is lower.
I would argue that. So Suvla, sort of in a very much kind of right place, right time. Delivery, you have to understand, wasn't really much a part of San Francisco life until probably about 2014, which coincidentally is when Suvla opened. And about 6 months after we opened, we started to see the rise of all of these companies here, Postmates and Caviar and all of those. And Suvla was never delivery was never part of the Suvla model. And so we kind of approached with a fair amount of trepidation. But it just so happened that our products happened to deliver fairly well. And it took us a little time to find the right partner. And we ended up making it work. And so now, fast forward almost 5 years, delivery is about 26% of our business, which is pretty substantial. And so when you know, people say, you know, well, delivery is not profitable, I don't have the figures to say that to argue against that per se. But what I will say is that delivery, is at least in the case of Suvla, allows us to provide an extraordinary level of benefit to the 130 women and men that work for us. So you know, obviously the healthcare requirement, whether it's Affordable Care Act or the San Francisco healthcare ordinance, is quite high. We're able to provide full medical insurance to all of our full-time employees, as well as a very, very comprehensive plan to our part-time employees. We have a 401k plan. We have paid vacation. We have ESL classes. We have a quality and caliber of benefit that we probably shouldn't have for a relatively small size. And that is really made possible by our delivery business. So I don't see delivery as a profit center, but what I do see it as, and certainly as we talk to our teams about it with respect to how we deal with delivery couriers and any of those challenges, the delivery side of the business is the thing that's actually allowing them to take 2 weeks of paid vacation as a line level employee. That's allowing them to start saving for their, you know, retirement at the age of 21. You know, like,
or for opening a restaurant one day.
Yeah, exactly. So I see it as a true value add to our business.
And I want to caveat that. I mean, it depends on the concept, right? Suvla has a very simple menu, and it's the kind of food that travels really well. But you have a lot of people. I mean, there always were things like Chinese food and Thai food and pizza that always had been delivered. And there are reasons that other foods weren't. Pasta, you can't really have al dente pasta delivered, but yet you'll find a lot of pasta being delivered, right? And so there are a lot of things that are in the delivery space, particularly in full-service restaurants, and I'm not talking about fast casual or fine casual, where people traditionally have bought at the counter and taken it home or done takeout. For those kinds of restaurants that have done well with takeout business, delivery can be a huge boon to them. But there are a lot of restaurants that are full-service restaurants that are not necessarily finding that delivery is additive in the way that it can be, because they don't know which is the right platform. They're on too many platforms. It hinders their overall service or makes them have to provide additional service to accommodate it, or their customers are getting a product delivered to them and they don't know if it's their quality, right? The quality assurance is there that you would have if you were personally delivering it. So, again, it just depends on your business model and the type of food, but increasingly restaurants feel the pressure to be on those platforms because so many of their competitors are and because so many people are there.
And Carrie,
yeah, I mean, Go ahead. I was just going to say it from like a consumer point of view. I mean, we have a 1-year-old daughter, and so 3 nights a week I'll come home, you know, work from home, and I don't have time to make dinner. And so Suvla is my go-to caviar dinner, and it's great. And it's, you know, I know I can have a really nice meal, and it's, I don't have to go out. I have to worry about taking my daughter out of the car, finding parking, et cetera. So it's like, it is really convenient for me as a working mom, and
would you ever think of doing delivery from Lord Stanley?
You know, we've talked about it, and we've got people asking us that same question, but we don't have the space. Mm. We just don't have the space. We don't have the staff, and you know, we have the exact amount of staff to sustain what we're doing on a daily basis with just being open for dinner. And so I just don't think that we could do it in the space that we have, unfortunately.
Great. It's definitely part art, part science, mm-hmm. I will say. And it's an ongoing evolution. We're constantly trying to figure out, and reevaluate what we're doing and how we're doing it, especially within the delivery space.
Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're speaking with Charles Balilis, Carrie Bleese, and Gwyneth Borden about the restaurant business in San Francisco. Again, the number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website or our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's go to an email from Richard in San Francisco. Richard says, when I eat out, I find it so expensive and good service makes a difference. Does the panel think that service is going away, and will it be automated or cafeteria style? Are we looking at a future where San Francisco will not be able to sustain the kind of restaurant industry we have today? San Francisco is talking about banning cafeterias in new companies. What does the panel think about that? So there's a lot of questions there. Let's start with you, Carrie. Do you think your concept is going to go away, the fine dining concept?
I mean, I would surely hope not. I think just going to the service aspect of that, a lot of our guests are regulars, and a lot of people come in because they really enjoy our service and our staff. And, you know, we're lucky in the realm that we've had pretty much the same servers in front of house staff since we've opened. And so our servers know a lot of our guests in an extremely personal manner. And I think that our guests like that. They like to come in and chat with our servers and know that they like to have their coffee a certain way. They like a specific napkin when they're seated. They like a specific type of water, et cetera. I think it makes it more of a personal experience for us in particular.
Mm-hmm. And Gwyneth, what about this possibility of banning cafeterias in new companies? Where's that coming from?
So the thing was, the city's rezoning 6 million square feet in the South of Market District, the last area of the city where there's an opportunity to really pull out the crux of the city. And that's all in Central SoMa. And there are neighborhoods there like Rincon Hill and the East Cut where residents have moved in, but there have not been the amenities that they'd hoped for. Then you had the mid-market space separately where there was a tax break offered to tech companies to move in. And then subsequently, restaurants that had already been there found that they lost a lot of their customers because they now had cafeterias in their buildings that were providing free lunch. And then all the businesses that moved in with the promise of, we're redeveloping the community, there's all this new business, everyone's going to come to your restaurant, that did not materialize. So ahead of that debate, the city's general plan is about planning a city. The city zones things. They zone office. They zone commercial. If as a restaurant, you can't actually have a kitchen on the second floor, but obviously these tech operations had large cafeterias on the other floor. The idea wasn't to ban free food, despite that. It was only to ban non-retail cafeterias in office space only. We have different use zones. So office zone, there's a retail, there's office, there's residential. So they were looking at, if you're trying to build out the last portion of the city where we can have major density, how can we ensure that we have a thriving ground floor experience? As you might notice, most of the new high-rises are empty on the ground floor. There's just not enough demand right now for people to occupy those spaces. And so the idea was, could we look at another way to encourage companies to spend their money locally, whether they're catering food in, providing vouchers to employees to go out, other sorts of things. It really was meant as a conversation. It's an imperfect solution to a real problem of, you know, if you are designing a city, which city planners and the government does every single day, how do you actually encourage when you're trying to have economic revitalization, how do you have a vibrant streetscape if you can't ensure the people within the buildings ever come out of them?
Hmm. Okay. So that's really interesting, because I read somewhere that one of the problems that restaurants are having is that a lot of these companies are hiring away really great chefs.
That's true.
Which actually adds to the worker scarcity issue. So thanks, Bill there, Richard there, for your email, because it generated a lot of conversation. Let's go to some callers next. Let's go to John in Marin. John, welcome to the program.
I got a two-part question about tipping.
Go ahead.
First, what do your guests think about the future of tipping? I know some in the area have experimented with eliminating it and just having higher prices on the menu. And the second is, do you think that guests should actually assess the service that they got and give a tip based on that, or have more of an attitude of cost of living here in San Francisco is so high, you should just always give 20% or more?
All right. Thanks so much for your call, John. So who wants to start with that one?
I mean, I can start off there. When we, you know, when we first opened, we thought, let's try the service included model. And, you know, it lasted 4 months that we opened, you know, and it didn't affect our staffing. I think that it's a hard thing because, you know, you want to pay a living wage for everybody. You want to bridge the gap between front of house and back of house, and you want to pay everybody.
Because right now the tips normally go to the servers, right?
There now that you could have the pool tips, so back of house, some of the tips, provided everyone's, you know, in agreement. But yeah, unfortunately, the service included model, you know, didn't work out for us for many different reasons. But one of them is, you know, it's hard. You have your prices reflect that on the menu, and you know, even though you have in your mind as a consumer, you come in and say, oh, this beef is $40. You know, you have to think in your head like, okay, that is including the 20% tip, but it's hard to think that in your mind, and you don't want to have to do the math as you're reading a menu and, you know, ordering your dinner. And I think it was hard for people to see prices that are higher than normal. And, you know, that was a big factor.
Charles?
It's a very hot button, sort of sensitive issue that I tend to not sort of wade into. I'm grateful that I operate counter service restaurants. And even though people do leave tips, I also feel strongly that we do provide a level of service beyond just taking your order. Your food is brought to your table. There's your table is bussed. There's a conversation about wine. There's a certain amount of wine service that's there. And our team does quite well as a result. We've been fortunate enough to recruit a lot of people actually from the full service fine dining space that provide a level of service that most may not expect in a counter service restaurant. But I will say that tipping, you know, has been part of our culture for, you know, over 100 years. So this is a very big sort of slow moving boat it's very difficult to get it to change direction, and even for those in the industry, I oftentimes, you know, sort of my wife and I struggle sometimes if we're at a restaurant that is tipless, we're actually now sort of powerless in terms of being able to do more.
Certainly, I guess you can leave more money, right?
Well, sometimes you can't. Sometimes there's just your check comes and you sign it, and there's no unless you carry cash. And mm-hmm. I don't know who carries cash anymore. But there you go. Good for you, Joseph. You know, that can be challenging there too. And then there's just, you know, the general consumer, you know, perception. I think to Carrie's point about the $40 beef, I think people have a hard enough time, you know, seeing, you know, a $12 sandwich and sort of understanding what goes into that $12 sandwich, let alone, you know, something that's even higher. So
yeah, Gwyneth.
Yeah, and I think we've spent a lot of time we had a couple industry conferences, and we've had a lot of people experiment in tipping, and what we found in general is that it's really hard to bake it into your prices because, as Carrie mentioned, there is a real price sensitivity. And the reason that people can tack things on at the end is because when you add up how much money you're going to spend, you take the raw price on a menu and you don't add tax and gratuity. I mean, a great example of that, you have 12 people go out to dinner and you ask them to pay what they think they owe, and it's almost never right, right? Unless you just divide the bill by 12, then it never comes together because people underestimate what the true cost of their meal is. And so what we found is that people, by and large, the notion of of being forced to tip a certain amount or the notion of a price being a certain amount made it very difficult. Some restaurants have been very successful in maintaining the no tipping policy or having it baked into their prices. But by and large, there was a lot of communication with the customer that had to go on to make that really work out. And the truth is, you are tipping for an entire service. And it is important for people to tip, whether it's a counter service restaurant or full service restaurant, because you're right. This is a very expensive place to live. I mean, I understand if you have terrible service, you should talk to the manager for sure. You should talk to someone. You deserve to have great service. But it's interesting because research around tipping does suggest that, in general, people aren't tipping straight upon service. They're like, I'm an 18% person, I'm a 20% person, I'm a 25% person. And that's kind of how people are. And if you really want to get into it, you know, there are other kinds of factors like race and gender that sometimes factor into tipping. So it's not so like I'm just judging whether or not this person gave me 20% service. I mean, how do you even define that?
I just want to say for the record that I feel strongly that other countries have mandatory military service. Mm-hmm. I feel very, very, very strongly that everyone should work in a restaurant at one point in their life. There should be mandatory restaurant service. Whether you're waiting tables, whether you're working in a kitchen, because until you've done that work, I don't think that you truly understand. And I waited tables for the last couple of years while Suva was coming up, and getting off the ground. And I think, you know, until you sort of see the other side of it, it really gives you a true appreciation. So mandatory restaurant service.
So I want to go back to you, Gwyneth, for a moment about the worker scarcity. Why is there such a scarcity of workers in this area?
Well, I mean, obviously cost of living is a major factor. It's very expensive to live here. I mean, obviously restaurant wages, they're higher than they've ever been, but still not enough for people to afford to live in a studio or one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. The competition with Oakland is great, that Oakland has a really thriving food scene, but that now means that people who live outside of the city don't have to commute to the city to get here to work, not to mention the fact that, you know, price of BART's pretty expensive. I mean, BART round trip can be a couple hours of pay alone. So it is as that issue, we're obviously close to full employment. In terms of competition of various other industries, people can make as much money or a lot more working in a lot of other places. Yes, the technology kitchens have been a place where people have gone because they have better hours and don't have to work evenings and weekends that you have to do in traditional technology industry. Traditional restaurant industry. And so it's all those things in concert. There's also seems to be less people who are willing to kind of work their way up in the industry. And we have a scholarship foundation, and we find that, you know, we interview applicants and we're asked, what's your favorite chef? Oh, it's Gordon Ramsay. I'm like, oh, because you've eaten in his restaurants? And like, they're talking about it being on the Food Network. And so there's also kind of a loss of an ethos of kind of starting at the bottom. I'm going to be a dishwasher and become an executive chef or an owner. And that's another kind of crisis point for us. But I have to tell you, it's sad the number of times I've talked to a person who's an Uber or Lyft driver who said that they used to be a chef. And I say, you know, we have a shortage in the industry. But I mean, it is challenging. It's not just challenging here. It's challenging nationally. And that's because of the last thing I said about kind of the changing attitudes about such a hard work kind of industry. But obviously cost of living is, you know, paramount here.
Well, that goes to our caller's point about should it just be service because of the cost of living for the restaurant workers. Again, I want to reintroduce our guests, Charles Balilis, owner and founder of Suvla, a chain of fine casual Greek restaurants based here in San Francisco. Carrie Blees, co-chef and owner of Lord Stanley, a Michelin star restaurant, recognized by Bon Appetit as one of the top new restaurants in the country. And you were just hearing there from Gwyneth Borden, executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association here on City Visions, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio, and on the web at KALW.org. And the number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also text us at or email us at cityvisions@KALW.org or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go next to Bill. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, good evening. I just wanted to compliment Charles on Suvla. There's one right near me on Valencia between 19th and 18th, and I like the fact that it's casual. Allows people with their dogs outside. I was talking with one of my friends, and he told me that one of the places that he knew about has literally gone to a pay at the register and order there, because so much of his former clientele is, or so much of his neighbors, are working down in Silicon Valley, and they're eating down there, and they're eating, you know, they're eating their, you know, a couple of meals, and it's really affecting their ability, you know, even in a neighborhood like Noe Valley, which is, you know, which is an expensive neighborhood to live in, and you know, so some of the catering that goes on at the higher end employers is affecting some of the restaurants. I don't know whether I agree with everyone should work in a restaurant, but I think it's a good indication of whether somebody can work and understand, you know, how to delegate their time when they're working, because if you're not doing one thing, you've got to do another thing, because you're prepping, you're cleaning up, you're doing all that, and it really you really understand what the business has to do. People in restaurants work awfully hard, and I really wish we had universal health coverage for all, because a lot of small businesses, you know, that's why they lose employees, because people need health coverage, and I don't think it's fair the way it is right now.
Well, you should tune in next week, because we're going to do a show on universal basic income. So maybe you'll have some ideas to share with us about that. Thanks so much for your call.
Bill, thank you. And thank you for the kind words, Bill. I really appreciate that.
Okay.
So we have less than 10 minutes left. I just wanted to get to a couple of other things that I've seen mentioned as some of the issues that are eating at, no pun intended, the restaurant business, which is how about, you know, do-it-yourself meal kits at home, Netflix, other types of changes in the way people spend their leisure time, basically a change in culture. How much of that food costs, actually? How much of food costs gone up in a way that would affect the bottom line? Carrie, why don't we go with you?
Yeah, I mean, food cost is definitely a big factor for us in restaurants, you know, and we try really hard to keep it in line. You know, we try not to have any wastage. And I think bottom line, and this would, you know, apply to us as well as Charles, and this would be for, you know, different style of restaurants throughout across the board, but people want to eat healthy. They want to eat local. They want to eat organic, and those items cost money, and it's expensive to eat that way. And the ingredients are expensive, and you know, we try to get everything from our local farms, etc. But it is expensive, and again, I think that would apply to all different styles of restaurants across the board, and that's a major cost. And I think people don't realize that it is more expensive than, you know, ordering a certain way. And I mean, I guess it's like your grocery shopping, right? You can shop at Safeway, you can shop at Whole Foods. So not that there's anything wrong with either one, but the cost is dramatically different.
Right. How about you, Charles? What do you think about food costs, meal kits, not to mention any particular companies, and Netflix? How has that affected your business? Or how did you think about those things in creating your business model?
Of course. I think with respect to meal kits, you know, I think that the jury is probably still out on that. I think we've seen kind of the rise and fall of the meal kit, certainly over the last probably 3 to 4 years. I don't know if that ended up doing as well as many sort of analysts and other people sort of had hoped. They would, certainly at least locally here. To Carrie's point, you know, we take great pride in the products that we source. I feel pretty strongly you kind of can't open a restaurant in San Francisco, you know, unless you are sourcing, you know, locally, organically, you know, a super premium quality of product, regardless of price point. And Suvla is no exception, but that is basically the standard now. I don't think that the dining public, especially in the city of San Francisco, is incredibly savvy, and they're very, very vocal. And I think that there's a very high level of expectation when dining out, regardless of price point. But at the end of the day, the consumer demands and expects, and I think deserves, value. at any price point. And whether that's you're coming in for lunch at Suvla and taking a chicken salad to go and spending $13, or you're taking your husband or your wife out to an anniversary dinner at Lord Stanley and spending several hundred dollars. You know, you have to be able to deliver that value. And whether it's, you know, Suvla, oh, I ate half my salad and this is lunch the next day type situation, or wow, we had this really incredible, memorable meal that we'll never forget, and I don't even remember how much I spent because it didn't matter, because that was this wonderful memory. We were celebrating some sort of an occasion or whatnot.
So I want to get to another caller here while we still can. We have Kabitra. Kabitra, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm very nervous. I didn't expect to get on. So the comment is regarding the gratuity discussion earlier. I respectfully disagree with whoever said that people are just sort of 20-18%, et cetera, type of people. I am exactly the opposite. I found out that TIPS stands for to ensure proper service. And so I will either give an insultingly low 25 cent a dollar tip, or I mean, I'm on disability. I make under $11,000 a year, but if I can afford it, I'll give $5 and upwards, like depending on how much I'm spending, because I hate capitalism. I think it's it needs to be. That's one of the main problems in our country. The only reason it still exists is because our educational system has been dumbed down so that there hasn't been a revolution. It is not compatible with democracy. And so if I have to spend my money for services, the way I feel when I leave dictates how much I spend and how often I go back. So in my neighborhood, there are coffee shops I don't go to because the owner makes me frown every time I go in. So if I have to go in, I want the people to be enlightened. I want them to be organic. I want them to be sourcing locally. I want them to be treating their employees nice. I want everything. And so I get as close as I can. And the more I get, the more I tip.
Well, thanks so much, Kabitra, for your comments. Thoughts around the table? Gwyneth?
You know, what I was talking about is actually massive studies and research that's been done around tipping. There's not to say that there are some people who don't tip very specifically. And it's interesting because, you know, there's two sides of tipping, right? There's the people who are sometimes more punitive, one would say, that they are. I mean, you've heard of the person that puts $5 on the table and takes a dollar away every time something terrible happens. And that is, you know, not that is regrettable, because I understand that people have you know, are on limited incomes and people have capacity. At the same time, the people that are serving them are in a similar position as well, and it really is sometimes things happen beyond someone's control, and it really is how they handle those things that really guides how they should be judged. Not that a mistake was made, but how it was actually dealt with. I think that, you know, obviously, all kinds of people are different. I'm just talking about national studies around tipping have generally found that people are 18, 20, 25, whatever it is percentage. And then there are people who are, I'm going to tip based upon what I think the service I get or how much money I think. And that's different. But the majority of people do it the other way.
Well, I think Kabitra's other point embedded in there is that people really want the experience. No matter what the price point, right? No matter what your income level, there's a sense of, hey, I'm paying for service, not just what I'm putting in my mouth, which is kind of goes back to both what you've said, Charles and Carrie. And by the way, this is the wrap-up comment time. So go ahead, Charles.
No, I think that to Gwyneth's earlier point, you know, if there is an issue with your service, with your experience, talk to a manager. You know, our managers, and I would assume the same for Carrie and Rupert, are empowered to do whatever they can to make your experience as good as it can be, and will bend over backwards. And so much of it is just about speaking up, you know, leaving less than you, you know, less of a tip than you might have, and walking out the door, not saying anything, commenting on any one of the myriad of online forums about restaurant experiences are not going to change anything really, unless you speak up and ask to speak to somebody. And if you do it in a polite and productive manner, and you're dealing with a well-run establishment, there's a very good chance that someone's going to turn your experience around.
Okay. And Carrie?
I completely agree with what Charles said. And, you know, there's you know, many times where you check in on your guests and you want to, of course, we're all in the service industry. You ultimately want to provide amazing service for your guests. And then, you know, maybe you'll see a review, et cetera, that says I had, a terrible experience. I really didn't like this. And you can remember, you know, we're a very small establishment, so we can generally remember who is who. And again, I mean, as Charles said, we just hope that people speak up, because once they do, you know, we will try to bend over backwards to make that a better experience for that guest and to change their mind and ensure that everyone leaves happy.
Yeah, but if you don't speak up, nothing's going to happen.
Exactly.
It's kind of the same way. If you don't vote, nothing's going to happen.
Right. Well, and related
Gwyneth,
to that.
Last word, ten seconds.
And that's the problem with the technology culture, is it's kind of the passive-aggressive approach. Don't be passive-aggressive and write about it later. Give people the chance to rise to the level of service you think that you can get, right? Like, the level of service you deserve. Don't be passive-aggressive.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. This is quite a wide-ranging conversation. I want to thank our guests tonight, Charles Balilis, founder and owner of the Suvla chain, Carrie Blees, founder and owner of Lord Stanley, and Gwyneth Borden, executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.
You can read more about these restaurants by visiting the links on our page. And of course, you can learn more about our other programs and tell us what you thought about tonight's program. But be kind. Visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Grace Wan. Join me next Monday as we discuss universal basic income in San Francisco. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.